Well, if you didn't recognise it, it was a classic Queen hit with David Bowie, in fact, singing alongside Freddie Mercury. Under Pressure, the words of the song, pressure pushing down on me, pushing down on you, splits a family in two, puts people on the streets. It's the terror of knowing what this world is about, watching some good friends screaming, let me out. Well, that's our theme for this morning, or this part of this morning, being under pressure and how to respond to that, how to deal with that in our lives, because that's the situation of the people that James is writing to. He's the author of this little letter that we're looking at nearly at the end of. Now, he's the pastor of what was the first ever church in the world, the church in Jerusalem. And the people he's writing to used to be members of his congregation, used to be sitting there on a Sunday morning. But then persecution broke out against the Christian faith in Jerusalem, and they left everything. They fled to different parts of the Mediterranean. They're homeless, they're poor, they're migrants, fleeing the Middle East with nothing due to religious persecution. Sounds very familiar to us today. And as with today, being homeless and poor and migrant made these people vulnerable. It left them open to exploitation and suffering. Just look back with me in the Bible to verse 4, just above our reading. James is writing to the perpetrators of the oppression and the exploitation. He writes there in verse 4, look, the wages you failed to pay the workers who mowed your fields are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. Well, look down to verse 6. You have condemned and murdered the innocent one who was not opposing you. See, it turns out that the lot of impoverished migrants was just the same then as it is today. People under pressure, that pressure pushing down on them. And so James is writing to them to help them deal with that pressure and to deal with it in a constructive way that is consistent with and indeed flows out of their Christian faith. I guess we're all familiar, some of us personally, with the destructive ways that there are of dealing with the pressure that we feel that we're under. Ways that are entirely inconsistent with the Christian faith. And James knows about those ways too, and he knows his readers, as all of us, may well be tempted to try dealing with pressure in those destructive ways. And so he writes to head that off, to help them. You can see from the outline that you've got there, he's got four things that he wants to say to them to help them. Two positives that he wants to reinforce, two negatives that he wants to root out. But just before we look at those helpful points, we need to be really clear in our own minds what sort of pressure these readers were under, so that we can clearly see the connection, the points in which it touches our own lives. The verses we just look back to at the beginning of chapter 5, they're describing financial exploitation. Workers not being paid for the jobs that they've done, harvesting and mowing. The people are Christians, James calls them in verse 7, brothers and sisters. But the suffering, the injustice in their lives is because they're working for unscrupulous and corrupt employers. The point is this, that the pressure they're under, the pressure that James is wanting to help them with, is not because they're Christian. They're not suffering for their faith. They're not suffering religious persecution. That they're simply suffering the sort of pressure that anyone can feel in life, in this world that is full of injustice and inequality. All sorts of things can happen to us in all sorts of circumstances that put us under pressure, whether we're Christian or not. Financial pressures, physical pressures with our health, emotional pressures with our relationships, professional pressures in our work and careers. None of them have got anything necessarily to do with the fact that we are Christians. They're the sort of things that can happen to anybody. But here's the difference. how a Christian responds to those pressures, how we handle them, it's got everything to do with our faith and what we believe about Jesus Christ. Here's where James can help us then. First of all, be patient and stand firm. Be patient and stand firm in your faith, is what he's saying. Have a look with me at verse 7. Be patient then, brothers and sisters, until the Lord's coming. See how the farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crop, patiently waiting for the autumn and spring rains. You too, be patient and stand firm, because the Lord's coming is near. And he's just said in verse 4 that the cries of the unpaid, the exploited harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord. God has heard their prayers for help. He knows the pressure that they're under, the suffering, the injustice they're experiencing. And here James is saying that having heard, one day he will come to intervene, to do something about that. One day, he is coming back to this world to right all the wrongs that have been done in this world. Not just the financial ones, but all of them. To call to account the exploiters, the oppressors, those who have perpetrated injustice. To bring justice to an unjust world. That's the encouragement that James is wanting to give to his readers. End of verse 9, if you look, the judge is standing at the door. But until he arrives, until he walks through that door to bring justice to this world, these Christians need to wait patiently and stand firm in that faith, in that conviction, that one day their Lord will return. Listen for that knock at the door. Doing that, living like that, being patient and standing firm is not easy. None of us would find that easy, especially when we are under pressure, when life is pressing in on us and causing us to crack. It's hard to be patient. It's very easy in our faith as Christians to wobble, to wonder, to question, to begin to doubt, and to lose that faith. And so to help us be patient and stand firm, James gives an example of what he means by waiting patiently. Did you see it there in verse 7? See how the farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crop, patiently waiting for the autumn and spring rains. This farmer that James imagines, he knows the rain is coming, which means he's obviously not a Welsh farmer. Here's a photo that was taken on Wednesday this week in the Pembrokeshire village of Eglwys-sur-Rhyw. And if you think there's a different way of pronouncing it, I'd be interested to hear. This Wednesday was the first day for 85 days that it hadn't rained in Eglwys-sur-Rhyw. Every single day since the 26th of October until last Wednesday. No one in Eglwys-sur-Rhyw was waiting for the rain. They were waiting for the sunshine, and finally, on Wednesday, it came. Well, James's farmer isn't from Eglwys-sur-Rhyw. He's from the Middle East, where it doesn't rain that much at all. He knows he needs rain to grow a valuable crop. He knows it will come in the autumn and the spring. And he knows that when it does come, it will be just what he needs. But until it comes, there's nothing he can do but wait, knowing it's coming. And knowing that it's coming is good helps him wait. It makes that waiting much easier. Verse 8, you too, James says, be patient and stand firm, because the Lord's coming is near. If you know that the Lord that you love, the Lord who laid down his life for you, is coming, is near, in fact, and that when he comes, that will be just what you need, will be so good for you that he will right all the wrongs that people have done to you. He will bring to an end the pressure that you're under, the injustice that you've experienced. If you know he will do that when he comes, that you will receive from him a valuable crop, something worth waiting for. Knowing that makes waiting for him all the easier. It makes standing firm now in your faith as a Christian, not wobbling, not doubting, all the more possible. Much more so than if you have no such hope. Much more so than the Christian message was just that there was a God who was good and kind, but has just left us to make the most of it, to muddle through and do the best we can. The prospect of his return is what helps us to wait. I don't know if you know much about sumo wrestling. Two pretty large Japanese guys facing off against one another. And the name of the game in sumo wrestling is to force your opponent out of the ring. The winner is the one who stands where they are, staying standing in the ring. Sometimes life can feel a little bit like a sumo wrestling match. Not evenly matched at all. We're up against some pretty large challenges. Challenges that look like they could seriously throw us out of the ring. And the challenge before us as Christians, in the face of what is overwhelming us, is simply to stand firm. To withstand the pressure. And what James is saying is knowing that the bounce, the time in the ring, hasn't ended to it. It won't go on forever. It really helps you stand. Now some of you might be thinking, well yeah, that is true. The prospect of the return of Jesus does make a difference to how I live now, whether I can stand. But James says here that the Lord is near in verse 8. He says in verse 9, the judge is standing at the door. And let's be frank, that was 2,000 years ago he wrote that. And the judge still hasn't returned to this world. So maybe we think he never is coming. And maybe, James, if you're wrong about this, well, maybe you're wrong about all sorts of things, and we're going to have to reread this letter a little bit more carefully. Maybe you're wrong about everything that you say about God. It's a good point, but I don't want to skip over that. The way I'd like to explain what James means by saying, as he says here, that the Lord is near, is this. What does the Bible teach that Jesus had to do to bring his justice to this world as its judge? Well, it says, first of all, he had to come into this world, to be born into our world. That he had to live himself a perfect life, to demonstrate his credentials, to be the judge of all people. That he had to die on a cross to provide a means of escaping that judgment that he would bring through forgiveness. That he had to rise from the dead to prove that his death worked, that he really is the righteous eternal judge. That he had to return to heaven from where he will one day return. How many of those things has he already done before he can return as judge? All of them. How many things are there therefore left in, according to the Bible's timeline, for him to do before he returns? None. Could he therefore come at any time now? Well, yes, he could. Is that what James means by the Lord is near? I think that's exactly what it means. Does that help us be patient and stand firm? Well, James knows if it does. Second thing James wants to tell us to help us deal with the pressure that we're under in this world is to be patient and not grumble. Be patient and don't grumble. He says, have a look at verse 9 with me. Don't grumble against one another, brothers and sisters, or you will be judged. The judge is standing at the door. When you're under pressure and suffering or experiencing injustice, it's very easy to deal with that by taking it out on those around you, those who are closest at hand, often your loved ones, who often have actually got nothing to do with the problems that you're facing. But even if others are to blame, others are piling on the pressure for the problems that you're facing, even then, James is saying, don't grumble against them. Literally what he says here is don't bear a grudge against them. Don't withhold forgiveness from them. Is if that is a legitimate and appropriate thing for a Christian to do who has been wronged by another. Withhold forgiveness. When someone wrongs you or causes you to suffer, James is saying you need to forgive them. That can be hard. In fact, sometimes that can seem impossible in certain circumstances to forgive those who wrong you. Sometimes it almost feels wrong to give forgiveness to those who've done wrong. But if you don't do that, says James, if you hold on to that wrong and you nurse that grudge in your life, then when the judge that you're so patiently waiting for comes to bring justice to this world, you will find yourself on the wrong side of that justice. You will find that the judge that you thought would vindicate you and restore you will be the judge who confronts you and condemns you. See, withholding forgiveness from others, it turns out, is a reciprocal arrangement with this returning judge. We do that to others. He does that to us. Be patient and stand firm. The judge is coming. Bring justice. Be patient and don't grumble. Or if you do, you will be judged when it comes. And then thirdly, James says, be patient and keep trusting, and you will be blessed by God. So the first point he's making is a carrot to encourage us, and the second point is something of a stick. Well, here's another carrot to encourage us. Have a look with me at verse 10. Brothers and sisters, as an example of patience in the face of suffering, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. As you know, we count as blessed those who have persevered. See, as well as grumbling and withholding forgiveness from other people, another thing that's really easy to do when you're suffering, when you're under pressure, is to feel sorry for yourself. To really allow self-pity to get a grip on you and how you see the world. No one else has got to bear what I have to bear, we think to ourselves. No one else has ever had things as bad as I've got them at the moment. Woe is me, poor old me. It's a very plausible story that we tell ourselves when we're under pressure. And to all of that, James says, nonsense. And he says it much more carefully, pastorally than that. If you're suffering, and you're a Christian, someone who is trusting in God, there is a long-standing, well-known tradition of people doing that all the way through the Bible. You are not the only or the first person to experience what you've experienced. Verse 10, brothers and sisters, as an example of patience in the face of suffering, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Elijah, Elisha, Daniel, Hosea, John the Baptist. You name them, they suffered. And in their case, it was explicitly for their faith, for courageously speaking in the name of the Lord when no one wanted to hear what they had to say. But as they suffered, they patiently kept on trusting in the Lord. They didn't allow their circumstances to dictate what they believed about God. They kept on trusting in Him, despite their circumstances, not because of their circumstances. Which is why they're so different to us. And why they're such a good and helpful example for us to follow. Because if you're anything like me, you allow your trust in God to go up and down depending on how well or how badly your life is going. We do that, don't we? So if life is going well, if the pressure is off, you trust God. Because what's not to like? He's giving you a great time. He's blessing you. Who wouldn't like him? Who wouldn't trust him? But then if life takes a turn for the worse and you find yourself under pressure, well, then you stop trusting in God. In fact, you begin to blame God for the mess that he's making of your life. You question why he's giving you such a tough time at the moment. Don't be like that, says James. Don't allow your circumstances to dictate your faith and your trust in God. Don't be consumed with self-pity and think you're the only one who's ever stood where you are standing, had to endure what you're enduring. Follow the example of the prophets. Tread their well-worn path of trusting in God, come what may. And allow their example, that path, to help you do the same when it's so hard to do. A few years ago, we had a very wet summer holiday in the Lake District, and on the one sunny day that I remember in 2 weeks, we decided to climb the Langdale Pike. It's a beautiful mountain at the end of the valley where we were staying. It's a decent climb, pretty steep in places, both going up and coming down. With all the children, the youngest, I think, of whom was there about 8 years old, it was pretty hard work going up and coming down. Lots of rests, lots of snacks, lots of cajoling, lots of persuading the children that they were actually having fun when in fact they weren't having fun. And I really wanted to feel that as a family we were attempting something truly heroic, truly something that no other family would be able to accomplish. Well done, the Spandrums, is the narrative that I wanted to enjoy in my head. But all the way up to the top of the Langdale Pikes, we were accompanied by a family of just three, with 1 6-year-old little girl wearing a pink Barbie rucksack and pink glittery trainers. Not a cagoule or a walking boot in sight. And she literally skipped and sang all the way up the mountain, as if she was actually enjoying herself. It was incredibly annoying, and it entirely robbed me of all of my self-important pride. Whoa. That's what James is doing here with the prophets. If you're suffering and feeling truly heroic and brave, mixed in with one lot of self-pity for what you're going through, remember all those who have suffered before you and yet kept trusting God. Allow their experience to help you be patient and do the same. Keep trusting God. And if you do, says James, just see what sort of blessing that might bring into your life. And the example of the blessing coming from carrying on trusting God in suffering is in verse 11. It's another Old Testament character. Have a look with me in verse 11. As you know, he says, we count as blessed those who have persevered. You've heard of Job's perseverance and have seen what the Lord finally brought about. The Lord is full of compassion and mercy. We have an expression, don't we, the patience of Job. But it might well be that James' original opinion here is a far more familiar with what actually happened to Job than we are. That's about as much as we know. The book that tells us what happened to Job has got 42 chapters in it, in the Old Testament. It's one of the longest books in the Bible. We simply haven't got time to delve into that. But suffice to say, bottom line, Job suffered a lot in his life. He also actually grumbled a lot. So it's not a brilliant example of point two, which is why James doesn't use it at that point. But he is a brilliant example of someone who, despite his suffering, despite his appalling circumstances, he refused to give up on God. He refused, despite much encouragement of everyone around him, including his wife, he refused to stop trusting in God. And as a result, at the end of it all, God blessed him. As James says in verse 11, you have heard of Job's perseverance and what the Lord finally brought about. Here on the screen is how chapter 42 of the book of Job describes what the Lord finally brought about in Job's life. The Lord blessed the latter part of Job's life more than the former part. He had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, 1,000 donkeys. He also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. The first daughter he named Jemima, the second Keziah, the third Kerem and Hapoch. Nowhere in all the land were there found women as beautiful as Job's daughters, and their father granted them an inheritance along with their brothers. After this, Job lived another 140 years. He saw his children and their children to the fourth generation, so Job died, an old man and full of years. 40-odd chapters of suffering and being under pressure. Job's still trusting God. He's not happy. He's not finding that remotely easy. But he hasn't given up on God. And so God blesses him extravagantly. Because he's earned it. Because he's proved himself. No, says James, because the Lord is full of compassion and mercy. In the Old Testament, God's blessing is material. And it comes to people this side of death. 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 20,000, 3,000 oxen, 1,000 donkeys, 7 sons, 3 daughters. In the New Testament and onwards, God's blessing is spiritual and it comes the other side of death. Which is not just much better because it is eternal, it's also just as well. Where would we put all those animals in Fulham? The blessing is different, Job denies, but the reason is the same. The Lord is full of compassion and mercy. And he loves, he longs to bless all those who are patient and who keep trusting him, come what may. Does that help you do that? Knowing the character of God that you're waiting for, knowing the blessing that he wants to give you. Be patient and stand firm, be patient and don't grumble, be patient and keep trusting. And then the last thing that James wants to say to help us deal with the pressure that we're under is be patient and don't lie. Have a look with me at the last verse, verse 12. Above all, my brothers and sisters, do not swear. Not by heaven, or by earth, by anything else. All you need to say is a simple yes or no, otherwise you will be condemned. Time's gone, we need to be quick with this one. But another thing that can happen when you're under pressure is that you can lie. Because sometimes telling the truth and being honest and straight with people is costly, and it gets you into more trouble and more difficulty than you're already in. And so to try and take the pressure off, you shave the truth and you bend it to fit. You don't quite say what you mean. You say what people want to hear. How often, if we're honest, have we said yes when we mean maybe? And we say maybe when we know we mean no. You see, when that happens, when that sort of comes out and is revealed, and we get a reputation for not being straight, for not being truthful, what we find is you have to employ added guarantees just to get people to believe what you're saying. I swear I will pay you back the money that I owe you. I promise I will. I swear by heaven, by earth, that I won't let you down this time, like I did last time. What James is saying, if even under pressure we can remain truthful, even if that only adds to the pressure that we're under, all we need to say is a simple yes or a simple no, and we'll be believed. People will know what we mean when we say. Verbal integrity means we'll avoid being condemned. Which is not about, I think, here losing salvation. It's about losing a commendation. Those words from Jesus that he will say to every Christian when he comes back to bring justice to this world. Well done, my good and faithful servant. Well done, my good and faithful servant. To every Christian who has been patient and stood firm in their faith in him. Every Christian who's not grumbled. Every Christian who's kept on trusting in him despite their circumstances. He's not allowed them to make them untruthful. Being a Christian like that is not easy. It's one of the reasons for church. So we can help each other live like this. But if we do, if do, then those words of Jesus Christ, the blessing of eternity with him, will be ours. Well done, good and faithful servant. Well done for living, for waiting for me like that. Let's take a moment of quiet, and then I'll lead us in a prayer.